Oh, go ahead and find Daniel chapter 3 in your Bible, please. Daniel chapter 3. Over the past months, like 9 months, I think, 8 months, I've been using my times of Sunday evening preaching to take a look, a little bit of what the Bible teaches us concerning how to think about pain and suffering in life. We've been calling it life in the valley, thinking, of course, of Psalm 23 and the famous phrase, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death." Understanding that the Christian life is not all unicorns and sunshine and rainbows, that we walk through valleys, and wanting to do that faithfully and be informed biblically as to how to think. Tonight is actually going to be our final look at life in the valley as we read Daniel 3. And we consider together how a believer in Jesus should think about and respond to suffering in life. I'm going to start off. We're just going to read it. Let's go start in verse 1 and then, I don't know, read down through, close through the end here. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, height of which was 60 cubits, and the width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples and nations and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up.' Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, 'Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?' Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.' Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and all of their clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew the men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. He said to his high officials, "Was it not three men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" They replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see four men loosed and walking around in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps, prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men. Nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way." Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Rakshak and Benny, as they are known to a certain generation of VeggieTales fans. If you don't get that joke, I'll get you the DVD. Hillary's got it in the library. And these three young Jewish men, rightly famous for their faithfulness to God in the face of persecution and unbelievable pressure to apostatize. As we consider their history together this evening, let's do our best to remember that even though we are privileged to know how the story ends, they were not. We read it. They lived it one minute at a time. Verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits, its width 6 cubits, and he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Do your history homework and you find out that this is all taking place in roughly 600 BC. Nebuchadnezzar was king over the newly consolidated kingdom of Babylon. Not to get too historically nerdy on you, but if we can paint with a really broad geopolitical brush, Babylon was about the third major world power known to the Jews of the Old Testament. Right? We started in the days of Moses and Joshua, when Egypt ruled the world of the Middle East. After Egypt came the Assyrians. Many of the prophets are written against the Assyrians. And the Assyrians were in turn conquered by the Babylonians, all of this taking place across literally centuries of time, hundreds of years. I told you, it was really broad brush. In the process, Nebuchadnezzar and his predecessors to the Babylonian throne, as all of this rising and falling and conquering and fighting of empires is going on, they have amassed for Babylon an astonishing amount of territory. And he ruled, when he says that he's the governor of the king of Babylon, he ruled over territory that stretched from what we know as Egypt all the way up and around, if you can picture a map in your head, from Egypt to Turkey, all the way over to Iraq, Iran, and even into Saudi Arabia. Nebuchadnezzar ruled a vast and far-flung empire that encompassed multiple people groups, many different languages, many different previously independent countries and kingdoms. All of it is now newly his. He's the king over all of it. So he says in verse 2, Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble, and then he lists all these guys. And you're like, who are these guys? These are different political offices, different levels of hierarchy throughout the kingdom. He's gathering together the satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces. Anybody who's anybody with any power and influence is coming to Dura to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So Daniel records for us this list of officials and governors and rulers that Nebuchadnezzar summons to the image. The intent here seems to be, on Nebuchadnezzar's part, and a consolidation of power. Here we have a king. He's not very far into his reign as emperor, gathering to himself all of the various officials and various government rulers that served under him in his administration, most of which will never have even seen him before, let alone met him. Remember, we're talking about a kingdom that encompasses just about everything that you and I would consider the Middle East today. It was all his. And by calling them all together, Nebuchadnezzar is able to assert his authority as king to test the loyalty of these guys as his underlings and to cement himself in their minds as the ultimate ruler and authority. And to that end, verse 4 tells us how he planned to go about doing that. The herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up." All of these plans and all of these actions taken by the king suggest that he wanted to unify his vast empire and make sure that it was abundantly clear to absolutely everyone exactly who was in charge. "You will be loyal to me," Nebuchadnezzar says. And he demands that everyone literally bow to his will. This was intended on his part as a public display of submission to his absolute authority in the kingdom. Essentially, what Nebuchadnezzar is doing, he's pulling them all together and he's saying, "Listen, I know you all come from different places. I know you got your little kingdoms at home. I know you have served other emperors and worshiped other gods, but I'm in charge now. And you will serve me." And just in case anybody gets the bright idea of doing something different, I've got this handy dandy little furnace over here that I will give you an up-close and personal look at. The cost for defying the king's newly claimed authority in all these things was made crystal clear in verse 6 when he says, "Whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a midst of a furnace of blazing fire." So when it comes to grasping the significance and the point of Daniel 3, you and I are somewhat chronically disadvantaged in that we know how it all turns out. In my mind, I want to rush through these verses so I can hurry up and get to the part with the angel and the rescue at the end. But if we hurry past these beginning verses, we'll be in danger of missing the whole setup and thus missing the whole point as to why Daniel tells us this story in the first place. Nebuchadnezzar is not asking the people of his kingdom to all worship his God. Counterintuitive though it might seem at first, he was not even asking them to worship him, really. Not the way you and I would necessarily think of it. In chapter 2 in Daniel, if you go back and look, he promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He promoted Daniel to high office in the kingdom, knowing that they were Jews, knowing that they served another God, knowing that they had already been through this in chapter 1. Nebuchadnezzar didn't particularly care which God you worshipped on your own time in your own house. so long as whatever other god you worshipped came in second place to him in terms of who gets to sit at the top. Nebuchadnezzar, he's a practical guy in that regard. So too, it seems, were the people of his kingdom. Right? They get the choice. You can bow or you can burn. Verse 7. Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. The threat of being burned alive will do that for you, as just about everyone on the plain bows down at the king's command. And that was really the point of the whole exercise in the first place. The king says, bow, you say, how low. The point was not religion, the point was authority and allegiance. And by bowing, the peoples of the land demonstrate in an unmistakable public way that Nebuchadnezzar holds their ultimate allegiance. That's all background. Having covered all that, we can get to the real story. If this was English class, and this was an English assignment, you know, one of those annoying ones where they make you analyze the structure of a story and then write a report on it, all of that we just read would have been introduction. What follows, beginning in verse 8, is what your English teacher would have called rising action. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Ingratiating little political animals that they are, these certain Chaldeans hate that guy. They go to the king, and they're tattletales. They report on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. King, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they didn't bow to the image. And from the perspective of Daniel the author, these guys are clearly the antagonists in the story. They're the bad guys. Even Nebuchadnezzar, from Daniel's point of view, who, after all, tries to kill them, comes off looking better than these guys, these certain Chaldeans. Their jealousy is palpable. Their motives are completely transparent. It's like they're not even trying to hide it. They resent the presence of foreigners in the government ranks above them, and they have found the perfect way to get rid of them. And as irritating as their presence is, and what they plan to do, at least they clarify the situation for us, the reader. At the end of verse 12, they state, they put it very succinctly for us. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods. They do not bow to your image. That clarifies the confrontation. And the king, for his own part, is a little in disbelief. Look at verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what god is there who can deliver you out of my hands? For his own part, at least, Nebuchadnezzar seems to grasp the situation fairly well. He perceives that the three Jewish men will not be bowing down to his image. They will not be paying ultimate allegiance to him because they already owe ultimate allegiance. And they will only bow before Yahweh, their God. Nebuchadnezzar, being the good pagan that he is, sees this as simply another battle to fight. more land to conquer. If you think about it from his perspective, I kind of get it. None of the other gods in any of the other lands that he's just got done conquering were able to deliver their devotees from his hand. So why should Yahweh, this God of the Jews, be any different? This then brings us to the climax of the story. We have an introduction, rising action, climax. As best as you were able to do, though, try and conceive of this from the point of view of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They never met Paul Harvey, and they don't know the rest of the story. All they know is that here they are, standing in front of the king, surrounded by hostile government officials and soldiers, with that wee little detail of a smoking, burning furnace standing just over there. And to make matters worse, let's remember why they're there, meaning why they're even in Babylon in the first place, not Jerusalem or Israel. They're there because God, their God, the God they are paying allegiance to by defying the king, allowed his people to be conquered and exiled as national punishment for disobedience and unfaithfulness. God did not have to let Nebuchadnezzar conquer Israel, but he did. In the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar then, the scoreboard is Nebuchadnezzar 1, Yahweh 0. Consider that at this point, these three men have absolutely zero reason to believe they are ever getting out of this alive, unless they bow. The king even gives them a chance, a second chance, to make a first impression. He says, I'll tell the band to play it again. You guys bow, and we can all forget this even happened. What do you say, boys? Can we put this whole thing behind us? Verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. It's like my second favorite line in this whole chapter. It reminds me of a line from Shakespeare where he says, I am not bound to please thee with my answers. Students don't like it when you quote that one to them. That's what they do. They look at the king and they're like, hey, king, I don't even have to answer you if I don't want to. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the image that you have set up. Man, what an answer. It's like my favorite paragraph in the whole Bible right there. I know it really shouldn't be. But that's the climax to the whole story. There's 11 verses to go in the chapter still. But you can get an A on your report by correctly labeling it as falling action, resolution. This right here, let it be known to you, O king, we will not serve, we will not bow. That's the point of the whole narrative right there. And you know who I think are their proudest people in the whole world at this point right here? It's got to be their parents. I mean, historically speaking, their parents are probably not there. They're probably back in Judea, and they have no idea what's going on. But still, if they did know, they would be super proud. These are young men. Some estimates place them as young as still being teenagers when they entered government service in Babylon. And yet, isn't that the goal of every parent? To raise kids who will stand up, who will look sin and evil authority in the face and bullies, and they will say, no, I am a child of the living God. And I will not bow to you. It's a tight balance to walk. This is not a how-to parenting talk. But don't wring every shred of will and defiance out of your kids. They might need that when they got to stare down sin with a king. In reflecting on the actions of these young men, John Walvoord has written this. He said, they confronted the king with their confidence in God to such an extent that their reply might be considered disrespectful. That was probably not their intention. They were simply stating their confidence in God's power over that of the king. Three men, however, also face the alternative that God might not deliver them. The expression, "but if not," should be understood as referring to the deliverance, not to God's ability. They took into consideration the possibility that sometimes it is not in God's purpose to deliver his faithful ones from martyrdom. The response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is the focal point of the story. When tested, they chose to remain faithful to God in spite of the consequences. Though they had confidence in God's ability to rescue them from persecution, they did not demand that God perform a miracle for them. Like Job, they could declare, "Though he slay me, I will hope in him." I have one quibble with Mr. Walvoord on this quote, and that is that I think the reply of the men was intended to be disrespectful. Not in an insulting sense, because chapters 1 and 2 of Daniel demonstrate that these men were otherwise faithful and respectful servants. But in the sense that they could not respect Nebuchadnezzar like they respected God. Basically, they were putting the king in his place, and that place was in line behind God. And with that it's like two verses, short, little, defiant reply, Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, they make their allegiances known, they make their loyalties known. Literally everyone is looking at them. And they say, "We are children of the Most High God, we are worshipers of Yahweh, and they will not follow, nor will they obey anyone other than him, no matter what it costs them." Verse 19 continues the story, but as I read, I can't help but wonder, what is going on in their minds at this point? They got to be thinking that, there's so much going on. You just read verse 19. Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and they were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because of the king's command, was urgent, and the furnace had been made extremely hot. The flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. As far as King Nebuchadnezzar is concerned, that's the end of that. He called this little convocation of officials and government functionaries for the express purpose of consolidating his rule and squashing dissent. 3 men opposed him. 3 men were fed to the fire. Now he can get on with it and enjoy his position as dictator for life. I imagine that King Nebuchadnezzar maybe didn't do this. That might be an American thing. He dusts off his hands. He sits back on his throne. Verse 24. Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded, and he stood up in haste, and he said to his high officials, "Was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" They replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." And he said, "Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of the blazing fire. He responded and he said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to the men that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men. Nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar, I don't know if he believed in miracles before, but he sure believes in miracles now. Can you imagine the looks on the faces of those 3 guys when they come strolling up out of the fire? This is probably why God doesn't let stuff happen like this to me. But if it was me, I probably couldn't resist clowning around just a little bit. Might have an attitude problem. The king calls out, "Hey, come out." And I'd be like, "Oh, me? Or him. Did you want him? Me? Him? Oh, all of us. Right. Okay. Yeah? What's up, King? That's why God doesn't let stuff like that happen to me. They saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. I can't go camping without everything I own smelling like smoke. They walked around in the fire. It, quote, had no effect on them. Back in verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to play the whose God is bigger game. Well, he lost. To his credit, at least he recognizes that he lost. Look at verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, insomuch as there is no other god who is able to deliver in this way." Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. The king wanted to play the game. The king lost. He says, "You're right, you win. Your God is bigger." And they all lived happily ever after. The end. Except it's not the end. We know that. Later in the book, Daniel is going to face the same choice. Well, instead of the fiery furnace, the preferred means of persuasion for his king is the lion's den. Worship only the king, or be fed to the lions. We know how that one turns out too. But remember, they didn't know that. Daniel had no clue. They had absolutely no idea that God was going to save their lives from the flames. And actually, if you think about it, the recent experience from life of the Jewish people gave them every reason to believe the contrary. And yet, they refused to back down. They refused to compromise. They refused to go along and do the wrong thing. That was them. That's what they did. What about us? Right? Chances are, no one is going to throw you into the fiery furnace. Chances are good, no one is going to feed you to the lions. Say what you want about our country, we're pretty safe in that regard. Please don't come up to me afterwards either and say, you know, try to make a political point. "Well, you know, the way things are going, it won't be long until blah, blah, blah." If that's what you're thinking, you missed the whole point of Daniel 3. We teach this story to children. Do we teach it to ourselves? Right? We put in the VeggieTales DVD and we laugh at Nebuchadnezzar. But do we take this lesson to our own hearts? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego give us an example to follow of committed believers in God who refuse to let anything except the Lord himself, even the king, even themselves, occupy the top slot in their hearts. How can we do any less when the stakes are so much lower? When there is sin in the life of your child or someone you love, will you do what is right and go to them and confront them about it? Or will you bow to the God of peaceful coexistence and just silently not speak about it? When overtime hours that you don't really need are available at work, will you do what is right and go home to your family? Or will you bow to the God of stuff and pad that check? When you are tempted by a relationship or romantic feelings that you know are wrong, whether because the other person isn't your spouse or maybe because they share the same pronouns that you do, will you do the right thing and deny yourself that relationship? Or will you bow to the God of your own feelings and desires? When you're at work and everybody else and your church or your friend group or your work group seems bound and determined to not do right, will you do the hard thing and speak up for God? Will you do what's right? Or will we bow to the God of peer pressure and just go along to get along. Right? The choices that face us today are not the stark and obvious choice between life and death faced by Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And actually, sometimes it serves to make them harder. It would do us well to remember also that this is Daniel chapter 3. And that this big moment of defying the king was not the first test these young men faced. You go all the way back and read Daniel 1, and you will find them taking a stand for God in the simple matter of what to eat for dinner. Is he standing up to the king, defying sin, being the only guy in an office full of people who's willing to do the right thing? These are hard things, big things. But the conviction to do these difficult things is not born overnight. The confidence to do big things for God when the moment arrives has to be built on the habit of doing little things for God when no one is looking. If you want to be able to stand up to the king and say no, you have to be able and willing to stand up to yourself and say no first. Randy Alcorn was thinking about this, and he wrote an article titled "The Cumulative Effects of Our Little Choices." And in it, he says this: following Christ isn't magic. It requires repeated actions on our part, which develop into habits and life disciplines. Our spirituality hinges on the development of these little habits, such as Bible reading and memorization and prayer. In putting one foot in front of the other day after day, we become the kind of person who grows in Christ-likeness. Once we develop Christ-honoring habits and experience their rewards, we will instinctively turn our minds to what makes us happy in Christ. If you desire to do big things for God, you read Daniel 3 and you're like, I want to be like that. You got to start small. Our purpose on Sunday evenings together over the last 8 months, 9 months, whenever I get to preach, has been to consider suffering in the life of a believer in Jesus. Daniel 3 and the account of these men teach us two things along those lines. Number one, they teach us that suffering may come into your life as a result of doing the right thing. It's not how we often think. We give children candy and stickers when they do good things in order to reward them and incentivize them. It might be a habit we want to rethink. Because Daniel 3 teaches us that you're going to do the right thing sometimes and you're going to suffer for it. Jesus never promised that walking the road with him would be easy. And it is entirely possible that you will encounter suffering in life as a direct consequence of obedience to God and his word. We see it in Daniel 3 in the Old Testament. We see it in Acts 4 in the New Testament with Peter and John. The Bible is full of examples of people who loved Jesus enough that they were willing to take the lumps when they came. But the second thing this passage teaches us about life in the valley is how we ought to respond when we are suffering and God allows it to happen. Right? Though he could save us, though God could spare us, though God could make all of the pain go away, oftentimes he doesn't. That was the experience of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We revel in the end of the story, and oh, they're saved. You ever think about the trip down? They were faithful, they suffered, and it didn't all magically go away when they prayed. Daniel doesn't record their prayers, but it doesn't take an interpretive genius to surmise that a couple of faithful guys would pray to God for help as the soldiers were tying them up. But for all they knew, for all they could tell, their suffering was not going to end. And yet they were faithful. They didn't give up, and they didn't bow the knee, and they didn't turn their back on God. They loved him more than comfort. They loved him more than themselves. They loved him more than the good gift of life that he had given to them. Sometimes we find ourselves in the same situations. Well, minus the furnace. Right? You're suffering, you're hurting, you're lonely, you're distraught, you're depressed. Your life is unbearable for one reason or another, whatever it might be. And we pray and we plead and we beg God to deliver us. God, make it stop. Heal my child. Whatever it is that you're praying. And for all you can tell, God said no. Daniel 3 teaches us that if we're going to be faithful followers of God, we have to be willing to say with Shadrach and his friends, our God is able to deliver us. But if not, see, God may choose to spectacularly reward your stand for him by coming through in the clutch. God may choose to hear our prayers for deliverance and send an angel into the flames, so to speak, to get you out. But when the suffering comes, will you have led such a life? Will you have cultivated such spiritual habits that even if he won't, we will be faithful to him? See, at Calvary Baptist Church, we want to be the people of God who say, along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we will not bow to the gods of this age. We will not bow to the gods of greed, to the gods of lust or career or pressure or relational peace at any cost. We will not bow to the god of our own comfort, because our affection and devotion is for God, and it is such that we will be faithful to him even when it hurts. In the words of Psalm 15, we swear by our own pain. We are servants of the Most High God, and we bow to him and him alone. And we will be faithful. It doesn't matter if the suffering ends or not. God is mighty in power and able to save. We'll sing that song. But even if he won't, let it be known to all that we will bow to no other. It's a quote from Job, right? Though he slay me, yet I will trust him. We're going to leave here. We're going to go through our week. You're going to hurt. Not today, not this week. It's going to happen. God can make it go away. Sometimes he does. But even if he won't, let's be faithful. Our hope is still in him.